I want to start by sharing with you one particular event in my life. I want to share with you a few snapshots of this one particular event. Here's the first snapshot. It's not me. Here's the second snapshot. That's not me either. And here's the third snapshot. Definitely not me, but he's got nice hair. Three snapshots of the one event. On their own, it's a limited view, isn't it? Without a sense of a bigger picture. So the picture is building, but we've got no sense of, okay, what is this on about? It's frustrating, it's confusing, it's inadequate. Limited view. So I'll give you my part in this particular event. Again, it doesn't really add a lot, does it, to the sense of a bigger picture, but it's building it. But again, on its own, this snapshot view is inadequate, it's limited. The picture's building because you can probably see on that shot there, it's an older shot, much more hair on that head than there is on this head tonight. But again, on its own, it's a limited view. Here's the best hint of this particular event. You got an idea? You know the person? Well, Gough Whitlam, right? Prime Minister Gough Whitlam from 1972 to 1975. The date? 11th of November 1975. This is the big picture. This is the famous picture that kind of encapsulated that great dramatic moment on the steps of the old Parliament House. And there down the front left-hand corner is this 20-year-old bearded radio reporter looking rather confused and bewildered by the whole thing. I was there. I actually have to acknowledge these days that I really was there, and this is not a digitally enhanced photo. This photo is actually in my kids' history book now. Not that they're impressed at all. But anyhow, it's my one great claim to fame. It's all downhill after that. It's a little exercise to show that our view of events, our view of news, our view of life generally is often limited, especially if you're looking at events or life in that kind of snapshot view without a sense of a bigger picture. In all the time that I've worked as a journalist, now for 35 years next month, I've had to take this concept of the big picture right through my career in all the things that I've covered and seen and experienced, both professionally, also personally. I can tell you that you also, as you consume the news, as you're a watcher, a listener and a reader of the news, you also get a limited view of what's really often happening in the news. Let me lift the veil for a moment on the kind of insider's code that the journalist writes with. Often necessarily because we've got to protect some of the people that we actually report, protect ourselves legally. But there's this kind of journalistic insider's code, if I can trust you with this, that we write. So we say something that's acceptable publicly, but to each other, as we know the insider's code, we're meaning something entirely differently. I'll show you what I mean. When we say allegedly, it basically means he did it, but we can't prove it. Controversial, he did something bad, but we're not sure what. Embattled, he should quit. We've been seeing a lot of that recently. Tired and emotional, drunk. You know, the politician rises late in the House of Representatives with this impassioned plea, tired and emotional. They've been in the members' bar for too long that night. Self-styled, I hope no one ever describes you as self-styled in the media because it means phony. War-torn, we can't find it on a map. We use that lots. Venerable, should be dead but isn't. Informed observer. This is where the veil totally gets lifted. It's often the journo writing the story. I'm going to trust you with this. One step beyond that is informed observers. It means the journalist and the mate at their next desk. The veil goes down. I've got to trust you with this. So, as I said, our view of the news, our view of life, is often limited, especially if we're looking at the snapshot view. I'm sure over the last couple of months, many of us have been urged to look at the bigger picture. If ever there was a picture that said 1,000 words, it's this. You know, as our financial advisors have been saying, look, you know, we're in this for the long haul. This is part of a bigger picture, so don't panic. Don't panic! It's been one of those kind of roller coaster rides over the last couple of months. Maybe we've learned the hugely valuable lesson that life is not just about the market. And life is not just about money. For if it was, where would the world be today? Where would we be if it was all just about the money or market? As I said before, this big picture view is one that I've really had to take through my career in broadcast journalism and in life. In the late 1990s, I was arguably at a high point in my career. At the time, I was working as a senior journalist, on-the-road reporter, sometime newsreader, as you've seen, and at the time, the chief Olympic correspondent for the Seven Network. We're 2 years out from the Olympics. I'd been the Olympic reporter from the very early days of the Sydney bid, from about 1991. We're 2 years out from the crowning glory of Sydney 2000. And in the middle of my summer holidays in 1998, just over 10 years ago now, and this is where the saga with the book starts, I contracted an everyday virus that any of us could contract, which, to cut a very long and torturous story short, began 2+ years in the wilderness of the very real and the very debilitating chronic fatigue syndrome. After many attempts to work through it and push through it all, I became unemployed. You could have blown me over with a feather about that. I mean, I'm the one who's reported on the unemployment figures for most months of my career. I could never have imagined that I would join the ranks of the unemployed for 2+ years. It now seems really strange for me to even say it, frankly. I would spend much of each day in bed with this terrible and very debilitating illness. And without being melodramatic about it all, though I'm a journalist, there were days in the midst of this where I would lay in the bed in such physical difficulty and I'd think, this must be what it feels like to die. I didn't think I was dying, and you don't die from chronic fatigue syndrome, but it's just what it felt like. Not nearly every day was like that, but there were days like that. My specialist sketch for me was this. He said, if you'll be in this probably between 3 to 5 years, and you'll be lucky to get out of it with 80% of your health. That's at the better end. And he said, for a start, you can kiss the media goodbye. You won't probably be returning to that. From absolutely nowhere, in the midst of this, you know, great life, 4 young kids, vigorous, interesting life, family, work, it became a very diminished life and world for me. If you looked at that snapshot view of each diminished day, it was a very small picture, hardly, as far as you could see, a big picture. It was lonely and it was grim, of course, and it hurt at numbers of levels. And for me, it also became a great test of faith, because I had no idea where this thing was going to end up, or if it would even end at some time. I certainly had no idea of what the future held. I mean, this is where you do find out whether there is such a thing as a big picture. See, I'd had, as I said, a strong Christian faith for 30 years. I certainly had all the head knowledge. I could never prove God, and I still can't. I've still got lots of questions about God. I don't have all the answers. But I knew enough to be able to be convinced that this was worthy, on the balance of probabilities, and history especially. It was worthy of my faith. But it's times like the next 2+ years of long-term chronic illness, such a lot of loss, and unemployment, where if you have a faith, and if you have a concept of God, and if you have a faith that there was and is the reality of a bloke called Jesus Christ. If that is where your faith is, well, it's times like this where it's got to be real, hasn't it? It's got to be big. It's got to be able to work. I confess to you that probably, I think because of my job, I'm a pragmatist. You will lose me if something doesn't work. I haven't got the time for that. So in the midst of this saga, it's got to be real, it's got to be right, it's got to be big, and it's got to work. Can't any longer be just a fairy story, or a whole lot of pleasant thoughts, or wishful thinking, or even theory or theology. When you see so much loss and everything kind of going up in smoke before your eyes, and such a vigorous, purposeful and useful life gone. It's got to be real, it's got to be right, it's got to be big, and it's got to work. And all I can say with absolute honesty and all the certainty that I know of life, and I'd be very happy to call it otherwise if it was the case, but there was not a day that I was not kept certain and safe and secure about where I was and ultimately where I was heading. There was not a day when that wasn't the case. Even the dark days, and there were quite a few of those. Even though I was no longer self-sufficient, which we all think we are, or in control, which we certainly think we are, which is quite ridiculous. Even though I was no longer self-sufficient or in control, it was okay. For I knew within this bigger picture, I wasn't alone. There was a bigger picture underway, although this is an important thing to say. You could never see it in the snapshot view. It was an exercise always of faith. I don't mean to congratulate myself on what great faith I had. That's ridiculous. But you could never see where this was going in the midst of this diminished and sometimes dark existence. And thankfully, in the end, God brought me out of this pit of chronic fatigue syndrome. I must say this also, even if today, a decade on, I had remained in that pit and unable to work, heaven knows where we'd be, and certainly unable to be here tonight, God would still be good. I've had the difficult experience, but the privileged experience of knowing that God is good, as they say, in sickness and in health. Here's an account of some more big picture thinking. Real people, real events, real time in the life and times of Jesus Christ. This is a story recorded by eyewitnesses. This is trustworthy history recorded for us in the Bible. It's a story about a guy called Jairus, who is the ruler of the local Jewish synagogue in Jesus Christ's time. Big shot. You'd imagine the standing in the community that he had, well, here's a man who's self-sufficient and in control. You might think that, but his daughter, his 12-year-old daughter, is ill and dying. And in a great exercise of humility and curiosity, actually, for a bloke in his kind of zone, of all people, he goes to Jesus, he falls on his face before him and says, "Please come so that she will be healed and live." A really curious thing that of all people, he goes to Jesus, and of all things, he asks him to heal this daughter who's dying. Mercifully and immediately, the Bible records Jesus as going with Jairus to help. On their way, a member of Jairus' household comes to them and confronts them on the road and says to Jairus, "Jairus, do not bother the teacher anymore. Your daughter has died." And Jesus immediately says to Jairus 5 arresting words. "Don't be afraid, just believe. Don't be afraid, just believe." frees the frame, Jairus has a choice, doesn't he? Either he can see the utter hopelessness of the kind of snapshot view and walk away from this man who offered such hope and in tears basically get on with the rest of his life. Or by faith, and that's all it could ever be an exercise of, he could follow Jesus in the hope that he might be able to deliver. The Bible story doesn't say it, but I would bet he had his doubts. I don't reckon he would have blood flowing through his veins if he didn't just in his heart of hearts think, you know, is this just a stupid thing for me to do, to invest such hope in a man that he might be able to now raise my daughter from the dead. Anyhow, he exercises faith, he presses on with Jesus. On the way into the room, there are people at the house, always crying and weeping and wailing, also laughing and scoffing, the Bible records, that anybody, I take it, who could be so cruel or crazy to promise life out of death. So anyhow, he steps out in faith and Jesus walks into the room. Again, this is something that is recorded by eyewitnesses. He goes into the room, physically takes the girl's hand and physically, historically, raises her from the dead. Let it sink in. I think sometimes it's a bit sad that these stories of the Bible are somewhat familiar to us. It's a well-known Bible story. How I often wish I was hearing it for the first time. Imagine if it had happened at 4 o'clock this afternoon in Epping, where I live. By 6 o'clock, it would be the top story on all the news. You can imagine the news story, the fuss and the amazement that there was one person who could bring life out of death. And could I suggest some 2,000 years later we could notice three things from this story. First, the need. Need was huge. It was a matter of life or death for this girl. Second thing we could notice, humble faith. It's all Jairus could exercise. He didn't know where this was heading as well. He was powerless, he wasn't in control, of course, and wasn't self-sufficient. He may have had his doubts, I guess he probably did, but he puts his trust, his faith in Jesus, and in the end, Jesus delivers. See, a bigger picture was at work. And in this snapshot of biblical history, Jesus transforms death into life. Who else has done this in the history of the human condition? And then goes on in his own life and death and resurrection from the dead to kind of live out that the reality that he really was who he said he was, the very Son of God. I'll spend the rest of my life getting my head around that. That in this man, the claim is that this is God as one of us who lives and dies and then is risen from the dead to kind of seal the deal that he was who he said he was, power over life and death, and ultimately able to offer us reconnection with the very author of life. One of my greatest tests of faith in life and work was this moment that you saw earlier. The date is Christmas Eve 1988, so it's nearly exactly 20 years ago. It's the newsreader's first television news bulletin live to air on the Seven Network in Sydney and around New South Wales. It is one of the worst moments of my life and a huge exercise of faith. I thought this afternoon, it was probably about this time of the year, like a couple of months out from the date, I found out that I was on the news reading roster for Christmas Eve. And I promise you, almost every waking hour I had after that, I found that out, and quite a few non-waking hours as well, I had this awful, imposing, impending dread that this moment would come, unless the world came to an end or the earth swallowed me up, which I might well have preferred, actually. That unless that happened, there would come this time, 6 o'clock, 24th of December 1988. And I'll take you behind the scenes again and tell you what it's like. You sit there, certainly for the first one, and there's a studio full of camera crew and all the rest of the floor crew. But in the last couple of minutes before you go on, especially when it's your first time, there's this chilling, dreadful silence that comes over the studio. No one talks. And you sit there, having gone over each of these simple scripts so many times, knowing that you've got one chance to nail this, and you sit there. It's just like an execution. Dry mouth, sweat running down your back. I could never figure out how those two work together. Still can't. And the silence is only ever broken by those equally chilling words, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, from the floor manager. The music for the news theme swells, red light goes on camera one, and it's you, so alone in the hot seat, and you're live, one chance when you wish you were dead. Is an awful, awful moment. And I always remember, in the lead up to this, feeling the dread of this moment, reading one particular article by one other newsreader who explained how he dealt with his particular dreadful first moment. And he played a little mind game with himself. He said, I put a camera in my mind's eye above me in the hot seat, and I took a snapshot of that. Freeze frame in my head. Then I took the same camera and took it out wider to take in the whole studio. So I wasn't so alone. There were three guys on the cameras and the boom mic operator and the girl who operates the audio cue machine. Then he said, I'd take, snapshot. I'd take the camera out a little wider to take in the whole studio. So there in that snapshot, there were people completely oblivious to what this poor sucker was going through. Wouldn't have a clue what he was going through. And progressively, in his mind's eye, he'd take these snapshots out wider and wider to take in the suburb and the city and the state and the nation and the world and ultimately the universe. And he said, from that big picture perspective, it didn't look so scary anymore. And I read and I thought, oh, what a gift, what a perspective to have for then and for now. And yet, from the hot seat that I still occupy in a different place, as I serve up this death, doom and destruction each day, I see perhaps more than anything else, I think, in the news stories that make up our news, people being confined or confining themselves to that small and frequently scary snapshot view of themselves and of our world. Seeking to battle along, for instance, imagining that they are in control and self-sufficient. I tell you, there's nothing like 2 years plus of long-term chronic illness to blow that ridiculous notion of self-sufficiency and control out of the water. So many are so on their own because at the end of the day they are disconnected from the very author of life, from God. Is it any wonder then that as we see in the news every night, or as we say at Sky, on the hour every hour, that kind of life, disconnected from the author of life, so often ends in tears? It's what the news is made up of. Jesus Christ, seen here in the Passion of the Christ, offers a better way and a bigger picture. Here's the executive summary. Faith in him, following him, reconnects us, reconciles us with the author of life. That's it. I actually think the church has made it so often so much more complicated. Certainly not this church. But generally, I think it seems so much more complicated and confusing and especially conditional. But it is that simple and it's that true. Faith in this man, following him, reconciles us, reconnects us with the very author of life, living the life for which we are all created in the first place. And it works. You may think I'm rather alone in my business in the cut and thrust of the media about this Christian life, and you'd be right. But I'm not totally alone. Remember, many of you would probably remember this bloke, would you? Michael Willacy. When I was a young journo, getting into this business and making my way, this bloke was my absolute hero. I wanted to be Michael Willacy. I so admired his penetrating, relentless, surgical pursuit of the truth. No matter what Shonk or Charlatan was sitting on the other side of his desk, he'd be carving them up slowly and silently and surgically. It was television art of the interview. He was such a pioneer in so many ways. I wanted to be Michael Willacy, my great guru. Time moves on for us all. This is Michael Willacy today. And it's only recently that I learnt that, to my surprise, but also my delight, these days he's been in search of, perhaps you could say, the ultimate truth of life, boring through to the heart of the matter. The ultimate search of truth of Jesus Christ. And he says this about himself. This bloke's no fool. Can I just say that? I had a very full life, and he has. And I started thinking, what's it all about? I think I got to the stage where I started thinking that if God was there, it would make a lot more sense. If I'm wrong, I'm wrong. But it makes the world a preempty place. The words of my guru, and I said, this bloke is no fool. Can I begin to close by seeking to put us in the kind of big picture that we saw operating with Jairus and identify our need? I'll put this to you, especially in this snapshot of time, especially with the events of the last couple of months, that our need, perhaps more than anything else, is for certainty and security. Not in the things that we have or the jobs that we do, or not even look at the share market. Actually, don't look at the share market, I don't want to know. Not in the things we have. I've well found out in my saga how fleeting those things are. I'm talking about certainty and security that lasts. And we will only know true certainty and security by humble faith in this man of history, Jesus Christ, who offers us reconnection with the author of life, with God. I'm also bound to say that a life of going it alone, where God gives us his only son and we crucify him and go it alone, it is actually a great offense. Of course, an offence against God, for which we rightly stand under his condemnation. It is a perilous position to be in. We need certainty and security. We also need forgiveness. But in the passion of the Christ, in his death, Jesus takes my condemnation on his shoulders and he wipes my slate clean so I can be reconnected with the author of life. Again, Jesus delivers from death to life. In each of our lives, we will all, and have known, no doubt, the good times and the tough stuff. We will mostly deal with it all in either one of two ways. either pretty much alone, battling along, often in tears, or with faith in this man of history, Jesus Christ, and as I said before, living the life for which we were created, and living that big picture of certainty and security now and forever. And if this is not yours tonight, could I be so bold as to respectfully ask what your decision on this bloke has been? And what will it be? Thanks very much for listening. It's been great to be here.